I want to start off here by going to video questions because we had a couple questions here from Hargunane Tane. And it basically goes into the question attached to the recent live PLO videos about how to adjust your cold calling / three betting ranges in live games, where I basically mentioned that you want to be three betting more double suited pairs, specifically if these double suited pairs have connectivity, hence like queen, queen, 7-8 double suited, for example, because the value of calling goes down when a lot of players are going to overcall your race. Now, when you three bet, even in a live game, you're going to end up heads up quite frequently, but it depends what kind of games you're playing, of course. I know that there are 1-2 games live, that there are 2-5 games live. When you do three bet, you still get a lot of callers. And in that case, you want to adjust, right? Because if you can't isolate the situation down to one opponent, it's not really worth it to be three betting these hands all that often. But if you can isolate, and if you also gain position by isolating, so let's say you're in the cutoff or you're in the middle position, and by three betting, you're often going heads up or against two players, one player from the blind maybe, it's usually worth it. Now, one thing that I see very often in live games is the lack of leading ranges. And you will also see it quite frequently in online games. So that means in three-way pods and heads-up pods, the other players are not leading into you because you are the preflop aggressor, which is not really a valid concept specifically in PLO. So let's talk quickly about why focusing so much on who's the preflop aggressor is not a valid concept or something that you should focus in order to understand who's supposed to be betting. So first of all, when you head to the flop, the first question is, what are the ranges in play? Because that's another question we had today, which is, what is your thought process like when you head to the flop? Is there a certain checklist you go down? And here are some ideas to kick that off as well. The first thing to consider is, what are the ranges in play and how do these ranges interact with the board texture? The second question to ask when you now decide whether or not you want to lead part of your range, or when you're trying to attribute who's supposed to be betting now on the table, you look at the stack sizes and you look at the positions. I would say you look at the positions first and then at the stack sizes. And with those three variables, you have a pretty good understanding of which player is supposed to bet how frequent and how big. Now, of course, this is all based on GTO, and we don't know always what the GTO answer is. In fact, we mainly don't know it, which leads right to the next answer, or the next insight, which is basically, the first thing I'm trying to do is, I look at these three variables in any poker situation. What are the preflop ranges in play? How do they interact with the board? What are the positions? Who's sitting in position, who's sitting out of position, and what are the stack sizes? Like, these four questions I ask myself. And then I'm trying to estimate what the GTO solution might look like given these four variables. And it's an estimation. I don't know it perfectly at all, but we have concepts to work with and throw around. And I introduce those concepts in various courses of the mastermind. So I use them like tools. And for example, I look at stack sizes and say, oh, we are very deep and this one guy has a huge polarity advantage given his preflop range. It's not given that he is the preflop raiser, it's given that he has the strongest preflop range. That is actually the reason why he's maybe on an A6-3 rainbow board having the biggest reason to actually bet, because he has the polarity advantage at deep stack sizes, maybe he's in position. This is like a good combination why he should be probably betting and the other players should be checking. So the first thing is to estimate what is GTO in this situation. And then you have to make a decision, which means you have to settle down with something because otherwise you can't move on to the next thought experiment, basically. So once you have decided, all right, like, this is the GTO strategy, this guy is probably supposed to do this, and this guy is going to bet very frequent or should be betting very frequent. Like, these are the sizings that are being used. Once you have determined this, the next thing to ask yourself is there something that most players are doing incorrect or where they're deviating from GTO that I need to put into account here before making my decision now, which is called a broader exploit. And I saw this concept actually introduced in Saw's latest video on Run at Once, where he talks about this thought process, right? And I catch myself that I'm thinking about the exact same things, which is a good sign, but he had some good observative notes, but also good wording or terminology for it. So anyway, I go into the second thought experiment, which is, Now that I assume this is GTO, are there players on the table that are deviating from it? And today we're going to look at some of those deviations, because the biggest deviation that people have as a population is the lack of leading, right? It's the lack of leading, it's the lack of check raising in single race pots, for example, when out of position. And once I recognize or I assume that my opponents are doing something that is not GTO, that is exploitable, I have to think about what does that now mean in terms of my strategy. And in today's video or in today's live streams, I'm going to go into a bunch of examples where I run two simulations. I already ran them ahead of time. And we're going to have a look at what it means if our opponent does not have a leading range, if he doesn't play GTO, and how we can exploit then our opponents. Because it has a huge impact, and I think it's very relevant, because the majority of the player pool will make this mistake. And that means that the exploit increases in relevance. So once I understand what most likely population is doing incorrect, I'm looking down at the stats of my opponent and think about whether or not he has another tendency that leads me to believe I should deviate from my strategy once again. And so the question is from Tanay: what should we do when we 3-bet in those hands like Queen 8-7 on a board like A6-3, on a board like Jack 6-3, and a board like 10-6-6. So let's head into these board textures. When he talks about or describes his game plan and ideas about these boards, I recognize that he focuses a lot on practical notes, which means, for example, he says, well, like the A6-3 board is really bad because we have pocket queens, and then this board is very difficult because we have Queen 8-7, no spade. And although those observations are true, they're not the first things that should pop into your mind. The first thing that should pop into your mind when looking at a board, as I was mentioning before, is what is the GTO strategy range re-range? Two ranges in play or three ranges in play. And then what does that mean for my individual hand? So the A6-3 board is a great board, of course, for the 3-better. It's a high EV board. We're going to make a lot of money in this board. And the Jack-6-3 board is also a decent board, not as great because of the suit out there. And then the 10-6-6 board is also a great board for our pre-flop range, because we are going to have a lot of equity with our aces on this board. So let's head into some simulations and see how these boards basically manifest themselves in terms of strategy. So the A6-3 board is a very easy board to learn from because, well, it's not super easy, but it's easier than the other ones because our opponent is supposed to check 99.7% of the time. And that will most likely happen. Like, most players will check full range, and they will check full range, in fact, almost all the boards, but also an A6-3. So we can actually work with the solution quite accurately. So the first thing to consider is, what are the equities in play? And I'm pulling up these equity graphs in the videos as well as in today's live stream, because I obviously can't do that while I'm playing, but I have them in mind. I think about two things. What are the raw equities in play on A6-3? My estimation, of course, of it. And also, how are these equities distributed? So here on A6-3, for example, you can see that the button has 62% equity. He's 3-betting, by the way, the under the gun player. And the under the gun player has like 38% equity. I think we're actually on the cutoff in this example against the under the gun player. Not a big deal though. We can see that we have a massive equity advantage, and also we have a clear polarity advantage here on top, which is defined by top set basically. So I already know that I'm going to be betting a lot. You can see it here, 68% at a time here on the top, right there. 68.2% of the time is the bet frequency for 2/3 of the pot, which is 66% for 33.7 chips. And it should not be a big surprise. The reason it shouldn't be a big surprise is because we have a massive equity and polarity advantage, and we are on top of that in position. So most likely the strategical output will be we will betting a ton. Now, we should already recognize that on A6-3, we're not betting every single hand, because there are a lot of hands that don't make that much sense betting. And the reason that they don't make so much sense betting is because of two reasons. Number one, we either have showdown value already, and we won't get anything better to fold. An example, Queen 8-7. Or number two, our hand is completely hopeless and is reverse blocking our opponent's folding range. So that would be a hand, let's say, like King Queen Jack 10, for example. Let's have a look. So king, queen, jack, 10, low frequency bet here on the flop, as we can see. 75% of the time it's a check. It shouldn't be a big surprise because we are blocking similar hands in our opponent's shoes. It looks like jack, 10, 9, 8 is more often a bet, I guess because of lower showdown value, less value hitting pairs, and also the backdoor straight around the 6. So here it starts off with a high bet frequency. That's totally fine. The hands that have showdown value are not betting at all. And that's really not a big deal. And because Tenay was a little bit concerned about the A6 3 board because the queens are now not hitting well. And that's completely true. But this is like one of the few boards where queen, queen, 8-7 double suited is really not hitting a lot of EV. But it's not a concern at all because I would always think of these boards and your hands attached to them in a broader perspective, which means if you check back queen, queen, 8-7 on this board, are you going to get exploited? Are you going to get destroyed on the ace high boards in 3-bet pots? No, you aren't, because you're going to smash these boards really, really frequent. And there are some very obvious ways to balance your check back range in a way where you can't get punished because you just hit the board too often. So for example, pocket aces is a great combination to check back on this board because your opponent has such a big... I mean, it's just so likely he's going to fold because he's not going to have a lot of straight draws in his open raising range, and you are blocking obviously top pair. And why is the bet size so big? The bet size doesn't have to be so big. I set up the bet size in this two-third sizing, and I would say the bet size should be adjusted towards what your goal is with your range on a certain board. So in the ace high board, for example, as we already recognized and realized, we have a big polarity advantage, right? And that is pocket aces. We're going to have top set way more often than our opponent. So we should be able to get all the money into the middle by the end of the hand. That should be one of our goals. Now, on this particular board, it's not one of our biggest goals, and I'm going to talk about why just in a moment. But one thing you should recognize is you should understand what is the goal of my range with a certain board. So when your polarity advantage goes through the roof, so you are very polarized, you have a very polarized part of your range, specifically towards the, you know, the good end of it, then definitely you want to be putting in as much chips as possible with that polarized part. That's the way you take advantage of a polarized or of a more polarized range, of a polarization advantage. And I talked about this in the bet sizing school. Now, on this particular board, it's not as important to be able to put all the chips into the middle. And the reason is quite simple. When we have the most polar part of our preflop range, which is top set, it will be difficult to get all the money in the middle. Because on this particular board, we're blocking so much of our opponent's continuing range. Now, if the board, let's say, comes ace, king, six, like in the bet size school, here in a 3-bet pot, deep stacked, we are 150 big blinds deep here, then it becomes much more interesting to think about how can we use bet sizings on the flop already that allow us to comfortably go all in over three straights. That is the way to take advantage of your 3-betting polarization advantage, basically. So here in this instance, I wouldn't mind if some of our betting range bet smaller or bigger, just because of the simple fact when we have top set, it's hard to get all the money in the middle because our opponent will fold so frequently. And then secondary, protection is very, very unimportant on this board with any parts of our range, basically. And that's different on ace, king, six. It's different on ace, 10, eight, obviously. And for those reasons, you want to have bigger bet sizings in these on these other board textures, for sure. So that's it for the A6 tree board. Let's have a look if we have some more questions. Are we having these same actions for three-way flops too? No, we don't play the same strategy in a three-way pot. Obviously, we have another player in the hand. And what that generally means is we have to be more conservative when it comes to betting. And our betting has to be focused on better bluffs or better blockers, which means when the flop comes ace, six, three, and we don't have an ace, it is just so likely that eight cards will include an ace, specifically when people drop the bottom 80% of their range. So card removal is really important when it comes to multi-way situations. And the way you account for that is in case you're not blocking the ace, so you have a bluff basically, you need some equity. So here in this instance, it could be something like a gutter, an open-ender, two pairs. So a hand like 10, 10, 9, 9 could be a decent hand to be betting on the flop three-way. But basically, you need a higher requirement for betting, for value and as a bluff. Q keep that in mind. And again, you fulfill the higher requirement by having better blockers, more equity, or obviously the value hand. All right, so I'm gonna move now into the next board texture, which is going to be a Jack 6-3. So the next board texture is Jack 6-3 two-toned. And the first thing that is really interesting on this board texture is when you think about the ranges in play. So there's a three betting range in position. It's the cutoff who's three betting against the undergun player. So he has a very strong range, a lot of aces in there, of course, some rundowns, but not too many. There are double suited. And the board comes Jack 6-3 two-toned. The first thing we need to realize is that the fact that there's a suit on the board makes a lot of the aces weaker that the three better has, because if these aces are not connecting with the spade, then that is that weakens the strength of the hand a lot because our opponent has more equity. Then secondary, if we don't have the spades, it makes it likelier our opponent has the spade, and it makes it likelier he will continue. So he will have more equity when he continues. He will have more often equity because the board is draw heavy, and he will have even more often continuing potential if we don't block any of the spades. So spades, once the flush draw gets introduced to the board, we should automatically realize that there are two factors. And then the first factor is if our opponent checks to us, we are c-betting now less often. So 52% on the Jack 6-3 board is the number here. Same stacks, has the same preflop ranges, just the board texture changes. Once again, the reason we are betting less frequently is because the requirement is now higher of betting because there's two spades on board, and a lot of the strategies, a lot of the hands that want to put in money into the pot, they have a spade. If we don't have any spade, we usually don't have a hand that wants to put in chips into the middle. And that wasn't the case on the A63 Rainbow board. There's not such a high requirement of betting on this board, because it's not a two-suit board. So once we know from a GTO perspective, the in-position player cannot bet this board that frequently or shouldn't, what is the adjustment the out-of-position player has to make in a GTO environment? And the answer is he has to lead. Now, when you look at the leading range here out of position, he is going to lead the flop, donk into the preflop raiser in a three-bet pot 25% of the time. Now, why is he leading into the raiser? I already explained it, but I'm going to come now from a different perspective. The reason he is leading into the preflop raiser is because he already knows that the in-position player will check back very frequently, like 50% of the time. And because that's true, because he knows it already, because they're both GTO players, they know each other's strategies, he has to start betting with certain hands to generate value. Because he knows if he doesn't bet, his opponent will check back. Now, when you think about the hands that he is betting, he will be betting a lot with spades, obviously. When he has two spades in his hand, specifically the nut spades, then he already knows, given the four cards he's holding in his hand, that his opponent will check back even more likely because he's already blocking the betting hands. And because these hands are valuable, like the nut flush draw is valuable on this board, he has to start leading some of them in order to generate value. So that is why on these more texture heavy boards, like Jack 6-3, more draws are possible. The caller of the three bet, even if he's out of position, has to lead into the raiser in order to avoid the raiser taking free cards. Now, what happens if our opponent doesn't know that? What happens if we play in a game and people just don't know that you should lead into the raiser? You should lead here with the nut flush draw or the second nut flush draw and some backup in order to generate value. What if these guys don't know that? They just auto check to the raiser, and a lot of players will do that, right? Well, then our strategy needs to change. And you will see a lot of players, they never lead. So it is a read to build quite fast and accurate on opponents, because most players will play that way. So here's a simulation I'm going to open right now on Jack 6-3 that has no leading range for the out of position player. It's this simulation right there. So here you can see there's 100% check from out of position. So I note locked the out of position player and forced him to check every single hand. So 100% instead of leading 25%. And now we see the adjustment from in position. Now in position will check back 66% of the time, where before he was checking back 48% of the time. So he's checking back a significant higher portion of the time because the out-of-position player didn't lead. Now, why is he checking back more often as an exploit? Because the out-of-position player has an uncapped range still. Remember, when the out-of-position player leads into the razor some of the time, when he doesn't lead into the razor, it means that he already removed some of the really good hands out of his range. And therefore, taking a stab is more interesting when your opponent has a leading range. When he doesn't have a leading range, the exploit, although it sounds boring, is to check back more often. So here you can see as an exploit, we're going to check back more frequently. So what I see a lot of players falling short of is they are over c-betting 3-bet pots in position. We saw that in many member reviews, and if I look at people's databases in general, we see numbers like 70, 80%, even 66%. So it's fair to say that a lot of players are c-betting in 3-bet pots in position very frequent. And that's not only bad from a GTO perspective. If our opponents would have leading ranges, it becomes even worse from an exploitive standpoint, which means most players won't lead, and you should check back even more often. You should check back 66% of the time. You should be c-betting 33, 35, 40% of the time in 3-bet pots in position, but most players are 3-betting the exact opposite number, 80%, 70%, which is a huge mistake, and what ends up happening is that your opponent can successfully check raise you for stacks. So that's called metagame. The metagame describes basically how the game is currently played. What kind of strategies are people employing? How do people understand strategy? Now that we know that most players will c-bet too often in 3-bet pots in position, and when we are out of position, new things emerge. Because when you are out of position in a 3-bet pot against the preflop razor, and you know that other player on the button will be c-betting too frequently, you have an incentive of actually checking full range to him, or checking a lot of good hands to him, and maybe only lead some bluffs. Because you already know he will be betting too often, and you can successfully check raise him and get him to fold or stack off when you have a good hand. All right, I'm going to move to the next board and talk a little. By the way, on this board, when we have Queen 8-7, we're not going to bet very often because, I mean, there are two reasons for it. First of all, I already talked about the fact that in position is not going to bet very frequently here. I think this is with the leading range. Let me just double check. Yeah, this is with the leading range. So in position is betting 52% of the time. Queen 8-7 here is betting only with a flush draw some of the time. And that leads me to the next principle, which I think finds a lot of relevance in today's topic as well. The more you check back, the more you have to protect that check back range. And what I mean by that is you have to slow play more hands, or you have to check back more hands that can face some heat on the turn. So for example, if the board is Jack 6-3, like right here, and you know that you're going to check back 50% of the hands, or as an exploit, maybe even 60% of the hands, because you're checking back so frequently, you should also realize that you need some really strong hands to actually check here in order to prevent your opponents attacking your check back range too frequently. What we're looking at is aces, so pocket aces with a flush draw. Doesn't have to be the nut flush draw. And what we see here is, in the example where our opponent does not have a leading range, we're going to check back 27 or 28% of the time, and we're going to check back only 4% of the time when our opponent does have a leading range. Now, why do we check back more aces with a flush draw that are apparently pretty strong hands on this flop? And the answer is because we are exploiting our opponent with our frequent checkbacks because he doesn't lead. Therefore, we also have to protect that checkback range by including more stronger hands into our checkback range. Now, when it comes to what hands are checking back here, the answer is it's the same hands than on the other board, just more frequently. So the range composition, the types of hands, the strength buckets are the same, but it's just more of it. It's just a stronger mix, so to speak. Then we look at medium strong hands like aces with diamonds, for example. So aces that don't have a spade but have diamonds. Then we look at the c-bet frequency in the GTO example of 37.1%. And over here, we're looking at 18.1%. So around half the range here. of aces with a backdoor not flush draw is betting anymore. Only the really strong parts that have either pocket jacks or a jack or an open-ended straight draw, like only these hands are betting now. So these are really the exploits to take on against players who don't lead, which I think is a very real thing. How does the 3-better react versus the lead on this board? Well, the lead on the board in general, when you lead into the raiser, you are representing a polarized range. So that already includes that the in-position player will play very defensively because you're saying, hey, I lead into you because I have a strong hand. And then the in-position player says, well, I'm getting a price. I'm going to continue. I'm in position, but I'm not going to be raising a ton because you are representing a very, very strong polarized range. But let's see how that looks in numbers. So let's say this player out of position leads into the in-position player. And we can see that 52% of the time we're going to call. 31% of the time we're going to fold, and 16% of the time we're going to raise. So now this leads actually into a very similar principle that we talked about protecting your checkback range. The more you're going to just flat instead of raising, the more you also have to protect your calling range here once again. So that already includes that some very strong hands are just going to call against the lead because we have such a big part that is just calling. And also our opponent is representing a polarized range. So if you look at a hand like aces with spades here one more time, we can see that 28-29% of these hands are just flatting on the flop because we need to protect our calling range because we will have a lot of weaker hands as well. When we look at pocket jacks, we can see that 98% of those hands are flatting against the lead because our opponent is essentially saying, I have a jack or two jacks. I either have a jack and a non-flush draw, or I have two jacks, and that's why I'm leading into you. And when we have two jacks, it makes it more likely our opponent is probably bluffing or betting light, and therefore we're going to flat. But one big disclaimer I need to put out there. Most players won't lead into you, almost never. But if they lead into you, it is very, very unlikely that they're going to have a balanced range. They're usually going to lead into you with a lot of value hands, but it's very difficult to conceptualize what hands are good bluff candidates to lead into you. Even for myself, because I haven't spent enough time in this topic, I would have some troubles identifying the bluffs. Now, the first things I would think of is the ace of spades, but how often do we have the ace of spades calling a 3-bet without the action of flush draw? And then also what I would think of is a jack that has a pair in his hand and one spade, like king, maybe king, queen, queen, jack with the king of spades. Let's have a look. King, queen, queen, jack. Yeah, king, queen, queen, jack, king of spades is a very high, very likely a lead. Then if we exclude the two spades, we can see it's an 80% lead. If we don't have the backdoor diamonds, we're always leading this hand. So like this is a leading candidate that I would use. But I'm very basic, right? In that, I mean, I'm more advanced than most people, but that's like my lockdown hand to be leading. But a solver would be leading many more combinations that I don't even know of, right? And you can think that most players won't lead king, queen, queen, jack with the king of spades. They will only lead for value, if at all. So that has implications to your raising range. So I would be very careful continuing when someone leads into you. But I think the main takeaway here is people are not leading very often. And I already talked about the adjustments to it. So on 10-5, on 10-6-6, you know, stuff happens on 10-6 people wouldn't imagine, in my opinion. So on 10-6-6, the out of position player is leading 30% at a time. And if we say, how often is the out of position player leading with a hand that is better than a 6 or a 6 or better. So I'm going to say a hand that is better than aces. The other way around. It's bigger than aces. Then we can see when the out of position player has a 6 or 2 10s or 10-6, he's leading 50% of these hands. He has 20%, like that makes up 20% of his pre-flop range. We can see the 20% right there. And we can see the leading over here, 48.2%. Think about it. When you call a 3-bet, you're supposed to lead trips on this board 48% at a time. So, or 10-10. Well, it's actually, well, one second. I see some aces in there. He will not have a lot of aces, but here we go. So it's a 6 or better, and we can see the answer is 50.8% of the time we're supposed to be leading. So half of our trips or boats are leading into the racer. Most people won't do that. Almost nobody will do this. Now, why is the out of position player leading a six? And the answer is clear, because the in position player is apparently not c-betting that frequent. If you knew the in position player bets 90% of the time, you would always check a six because it's the best play you can check raise and get more money into the middle. You can get your opponent to bluff. That's awesome when you have a six, right, or a boat. But apparently, this is a GTO solution, and in the GTO solution, the in position player will not bet 100% of his range in this board. I think a lot of people are doing a poor job over c-betting this board because people are not leading into them. And the way we can adjust and take advantage of that is we are check raising more often as a bluff. We're check raising more often with sixes instead of leading, but I would still advise you to be leading some of the sixes and some of the 10-6 hands. And the hands that make most sense to be leading as a bluff, let's go over right here, are always resolving around equity and or potential to triple barrel. So let's have a look what kind of hands are potentially leading here. So when we take a hand that has no six or no 10-10, and we look at the leading range, we can see here we have the nut flush draw. So let's say we have ace of hearts with two hearts. The nut flush draw is leading around 50% of the time. Now, the reason the nut flush draw is leading is twofold. First of all, some of these hands are pretty strong when it gets some value, sure. And we know if we have the ace of hearts, our opponent will check back very frequent. So we want to get that value now. And then secondly, if we turn the nut flush, we have a value hand. We can actually bet for value because our opponent's 3-bet range will just not be strong enough to disincentivize us from value betting on 10-6-6. He's just not going to have enough boats. So we can apply a lot of pressure and at the same time get there and then value bet our hand with a nut flush draw. So 50% of the nut flush draws are betting. Now next, what about a 10? So a 10 here is betting only 33.9% of the time because it has less equity and it will be less of an important blocker down the road. It's not like you can bet a 10 on the flop and then the board never changes and your 10 blocker is super valuable. There are going to be some very strong shifts, specifically with the hearts that are coming in. So the value of the 10 is not that great down the road. If we take away the ace of hearts now, we can see 35.1% of these hands are leading. Yeah, and I would say, generally speaking, I would be leading here hands. I wouldn't make it a huge part of my strategy as an exploit because people are just over c-betting and can check raise. And I would use some of these hands that are leading here, like the nut flush draw, like a 10x with a flush draw, with a heart blocker, 10-8-7, 10-9-7 with backdoor diamonds. I would use these hands and generally put them into my check raising range instead of my leading range. This way, you get your opponent to bluff, but also you get your opponent to fold down the road much more likely than if you just lead into him for multiple streets because you can leverage the whole stack size. Other hands that make sense to lead are right away pocket pairs. Whenever you look at a paired board, then the double pair hands you have in your preflop range are the first candidates to put pressure on your opponents because they have really good outs. Although we only have four outs with 2-2-3-3 or 5-5-2-2, 2-2-9-9, King-King-2-2, we only have four outs to a full house. These outs are extremely valuable, and we still have a hand that can win a showdown some of the time. Specifically with a hand like Jack-Jack-Deuce-Deuce, we can still lead into our opponent, and our opponent can call like the nut flush draw, and we can still win at showdown. But these hands have the best outs, basically, apart from the nut flush draw, which we already talked about. All right, we're going to put this away here. Just going to take a couple more questions about this before moving into new hands. How often can we start check raising the nut flush draw out of position? I would check raise it very, very frequent. And the thing is, the advantage with the nut flush draw here, let me just go to it, is because your opponent is so unlikely to have a six or a boat, you can actually pot a lot of turn cards and commit. You can apply a lot of pressure with these hands because your outs are very valuable. Let me just double check where the solution is. Here you go. So I find the nut flush draw functions better as a check raise, just because just because I see a lot of players that are going to call a check raise and then fold against a pot size turn bet. I would probably focus around when you have a nut flush draw that has a backdoor flush draw or a gut shot or a backdoor open ender. In that case, this would be a hand, let's say, like ace 9-7 or ace high flush draw with king queen, for example, or queen jack of diamonds. Hands that basically can pot a few more turn cards. I would think these hands are better to be check raising the flop pot in the turn. And then more naked nut flush draws are better to just be leading the flop and applying pressure that way. That's pretty much how I would structure it there. Benjamin says, part of them overfolding to c-bets on boards like this is them calling too many 3-bets and being unable to beat aces. So the check fold or cold call with flush draws. The other part is general under aggro, so they don't bluff enough. I totally agree. I mean, betting a ton on these boards is definitely an exploitive adjustment that works out quite well. But hopefully, against everyone who's listening to this, it's not going to work out that well in the future because they understand the situation better. All right, we have one more board that we're going to work from a sim off. It's a King 9-6 board. And this is just going to be a quick recap. It's a hand that has been posted in the live training chat. And we're going to reiterate and get confirmation on what we already know now. So live training chat, go up here to this hand from Hacko. And we looked down at ace 10-7 double suited, under the gun raises. We are 3-betting from the cutoff. Everyone folds, under the gun calls. The stack sizes in play here are at 100 big blinds. And the flop comes king 9-6 with two clubs. You can see the board right there. And the action is the following. It goes check, check on the flop with our open overpair and backdoor nut flush draw and nut gut shot an 8. And turn is the king of diamonds. Generally speaking, great cards. It goes check, check once again. River's an 8. So at this point, we make a straight. It goes check, under the gun bets, and we face a fold. And the question is here, was this the correct line to take? And what happens here in the flop on king 9-6? So let's think about this a little bit. So Hacko says, I'm mostly thinking about turn. If I should bet for value and or protection here. Okay. So let's put a few things together. The first thing I want to put it to pay attention to is king 9-6. I'm putting the board away here for a second. On king 9-6 with two clubs, there's a lot of texture, right? And also when you think about the 3-betting range has a lot of aces. And the 3-betting range shouldn't have a lot of like king, queen, jack, 10 type of hands. Even if these hands are double suited, they're often being called. King 9-6 is the board. So other 3-bet candidates would be jack 10-9-7, 10-9-8-7, like lower straight draws with middle pair. But when we look at the board texture, we see that the 9 of clubs is on the board, which means 9x double suited will not have a club draw. Is that correct? Well, it can have a club draw, but it's going to be a low club draw, right? It's like 10-9 of hearts and 8-7 of clubs. That's possible, yeah. Those are strong combos. Unlikely, but they're strong. So basically what happens on this board, what happens on this board is aces are a little bit in a trouble situation because when they don't come along with another set, like ace, king, or ace, king, king, or the nut flush draw, they're a little bit in a trouble spot. And because the board is two-toned, our exact holding, the club basically matters a ton. So that means two things that we already learned in today's live stream. Number one, suits matter a lot, and therefore the in-position player will not be c-betting a very high frequency. And number two, because he's not c-betting a very high frequency, the out-of-position player needs to lead into him with certain combinations. And we already know what the value combos are, right? It's like king-king should probably lead some of the time, specifically when he's blocking clubs. And then the nut flush draw should be leading some of the time because when we have the nut flush draw as an out of position caller for 3-bet, most likely our opponent will check back on the flop. We want to generate value or get some mate hands to fold. And then what hands are bluffing? Well, king, queen, queen, jack with the queen of clubs is probably bluffing out of position. Let's double check here. King, queen, queen, jack with the with a club, but not two clubs, is leading 81% of the time. So like, I can draw these ideas already from just the other simulation because the concepts hold through over multiple different board textures. That's the advantage of dissecting boards in more detail and then taking away concepts. So now that we know that, and we think back at ace, ace, 10-7 with two hearts and two spades, then we already know that this hand is not going to be bet in position. Let's have a look at the overall bet frequency here. Once it gets checked, I used two bet size options for in position and out of position. We can see that the in position player here is... I used two bet sizes, 50% and 100%, and we can see that we are checking back 55.4% of the time. Now, what we also know from today's lesson is that we probably should be checking back more often because our opponent is not going to lead the appropriate frequency, if any. The appropriate frequency here is to lead around 30% of the pre-flop range of the under-the-gun player. So the out-of-position caller for 3-bet should be leading 30% of the time. He's checking 70. And let's have a look at a simulation where we have no leading range, which is much more likely to happen. So here we go. This is a simulation where the out-of-position player cannot lead. Always checks 100%. And the in-position player is going to check back 75% of the time. Now, what hands are checking back? And we already know now that we do need some protection because we are checking back so frequently, so we do need some slow plays. Another takeaway we should have here is if we are the caller for 3-bet, we need to start leading these boards. Not as frequent as the GTO solution because we can benefit from some oversee betters, but we should, generally speaking, lead. All right, let's have a quick look. We have some questions here. Are we more incentivized to lead out of position in these spots against weaker opponents or less? I would be leading, generally speaking. I think weaker opponents, less experienced opponents, they play very shy, so to speak. So they're just trying to get the showdown with their aces. They don't want to lose with aces. And they tend to small ball at post-flop. And I like to lead into those guys when I have a really good hand or when I do have some good blockers for the future and also immediate blockers. We already talked about the hands that are important here in this specific board. Against regulars that play poor strategy of oversee betting, you can also check in on their flop c-bet frequency in single raise pots. But people who are very bet happy on the flop in general, I like to be checking a little bit too often unless I have a great block or bluff. Because when I have king, queen, queen, jack with the queen of clubs, I don't want to check raise for stacks. Like I don't want to do that, right? So I want to lead those bluff combos because check raising would be too risky. It's like risking too much with low equity, basically. So these bluffs I would be leading, and some of the value hands I would be check raising as an exploit.